helping our pets stay healthy. We often refer to our pets as members of our family, and in fact, pets are affected by many of the same problems that humans deal with today. One example, tick-borne diseases. In Maine, we're seeing a steep rise in people contracting different diseases that are caused by tick bites. That means that animals are at risk as well. Another example is anxiety, something that our human society is seeing more of, pets are too. And we'll learn what options are available to address their emotional health. Even the trend among us humans toward different diet choices, from grain-free to probiotic, is spilling over into the world of pet food. I'm Cindy Hahn. Join me to learn about the latest veterinary news and to get advice about your dog, cat, rabbit, lizard, and other family members. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. We tend to treat our pets as humans, not only because they're part of the family, but because they deal with many of the same issues that we do, from ticks to anxiety to diets. We'll talk about some of the challenges facing our pets, and we'll answer your pet questions. Joining me in the studio, Dr. Jennifer Kopp. She is a veterinarian with Tender Touch Veterinary Hospital, where she's the medical director. And Dr. Ezra Steinberg, he's a surgeon with Maine Veterinary Medical Center. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Are you wondering what to do to protect your dog or cat from ticks this time of year? Trying to sort through the dizzying array of new pet food choices out there? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Kopp, we've talked on this show before about what to do about ticks and Lyme disease, but now Maine is seeing a dramatic rise in other tick-borne diseases like anaplasmosis, babesiosis. We're hearing about that now. What are you seeing in dogs and cats right now?
I would have to agree that we're seeing an increase in diseases as well, not only Lyme, but anaplasma. I can't comment too much on the babesiosis because I don't know that I've actually seen that in our pet population, but it's definitely a risk. And I think the biggest issue is we've been focusing on Lyme disease for so long. We have a vaccine for it. You know, we know the time it takes to basically transmit Lyme disease in our pets from ticks, that people are kind of forgetting about the other diseases out there like Ehrlichia and anaplasma. And so we are seeing an increase in anaplasma in particular in our area. And it's something that I think we have to be adamant about prevention still. And so I think certainly doing the flea and tick prevention every month is still very important.
Okay, and actually, I think people forget that this time of year, October and November, is still peak tick season.
Yes, absolutely. In the summer, you know, people are very adamant about it, and they know that they're out. But really, the spring and fall is when we see the biggest rise in our tick populations. We get the little nymphs out there that transmit Lyme as well. And so people just don't think about it because it's getting cooler, and they're everywhere. The little baby ticks are out, and they definitely transmit it just as effectively.
Okay, I'm going to throw in my very own dog question, just because my dog tested positive for anaplasmosis, that it's present, but then it was explained to me that doesn't mean he's currently, that you need to do anything about it. Can you explain that, Ezra?
Yeah, that's correct. So there's so much tick exposure in Maine, and one of the baseline tests that we do beyond basic screening blood work, we're testing animals for tick-borne diseases almost annually. And when you get a positive in a person, it's usually highly concerning, especially with Lyme. Like if you contract Lyme disease in people, chances are you're going to have clinical signs. In dogs, it's anywhere from about 4 to 10% of dogs. So 90 out of 100 dogs out there walking around with Lyme disease are not going to show clinical signs. So I would say you're getting these positives, and it's depending on what veterinarian is treating, sometimes it's not even worth prescribing antibiotics. And the clinical signs associated with these can be variable. So like with Lyme disease, it's the most common. So I'm a surgeon, so dogs come in all the time limping. And often pet owners want to blame it on Lyme disease, which is rare. It's very rare that that's the cause of the lameness. But then you get this entire variable clinical signs from anaplasma and Ehrlichia that are, you have to go on a major hunt. They can produce with stuff cardiac disease, neurologic disease, vascular disease, and you're really on a hunt and it's very difficult to diagnose. So echoing Dr. Kopp's thoughts about prevention, it's just so much easier to do very strict tick prevention than go on this diagnostic search that oftentimes comes up unrewarding.
I do want to throw out there, too, when we do get an anaplasma positive or Lyme positive dog, you know, I know it's a lot of times it's hard for kind of pet parents to want to put the money towards more testing. And mm-hmm. I think that can be pretty frustrating for both parties. But the reason why we do it is because those tests look for exposure, or at least the screening test. So that tells us there's antibodies present. So at some point, they saw the actual antigen or the actual bacteria there. Their body mounted an immune response. So just because they're positive, it doesn't mean that they're actually currently infected. And so the concern then becomes, do we just ignore it? Do we treat it? Or do we look further to see if there's actual test, antigen there? And so sometimes we'll recommend sending out more tests, like a PCR, to confirm that it's there, or actually sending out like a complete blood count to look at the red blood cells and platelets, which these, you know, diseases can affect. And so that's why we recommend it. And I know some people, you know, they get very frustrated when they feel like they go to the vet and we just say test after test. But there's usually a reason behind mm-hmm. it. And so just trying to understand, you know, have people understand that instead of just throwing antibiotics, you know, make a decision, do we actually need to treat or is this just exposure? So that's what those additional tests would help us with.
Okay, great. Along the same idea that pets get the same problems that people do, can we talk about stress and anxiety in pets? It's definitely something you hear about more. And now it's become hugely popular to turn to CBD products to ease anxiety. What is your stance on that?
So CBD is the new trend. We have owners that just want to give their animals CBD because they themselves have taken it or they've been reading about it or they see it at the counter at the convenience store because it's everywhere now.
Yes.
It's still very difficult because this is not technically a drug. So it doesn't have a wide body of research behind it. We are not allowed to claim efficacy for mm-hmm. CBD yet. Because it's a supplement. So because it's not regulated yet, we can't claim efficacy. There have been some very recent studies. So like it's only been happening in the past couple of years. Cornell University is doing some stuff that what we're researching now is more related to seizures, like it is in people. So CBD for treatment of seizures and for osteoarthritis. As far as I know, the anxiety relief, that is still somewhat investigational, but it's coming out there for sure. And it's like any kind of supplement that we deal with. That some people say that it has changed their animal's life, and I can't argue with that. But mm-hmm. as veterinarians, we really have to stick to evidence-based medicine, and we can't just go on anecdotal success of one or two dogs. We have to wait for the research to come out. And still, at this time, you cannot claim efficacy of the products. You can say, sure, feel free to. It's not illegal. It probably won't hurt, although we don't know 100% that it won't. And let me know what you think of it.
And that is one of the cautions. You don't quite know that it could still have risks, right? If you're taking something that's not regulated, what are the possible problems with something like CBD?
Sure, and they do have some safety studies that are out now, so we feel pretty confident that it's not going to hurt at the recommended dose. But this is the same with glucosamine chondroitin. We don't know 100%. You cannot claim efficacy of these supplements.
Okay. Well, then what are some other ways to address anxiety other than that? Some basic tips if your dog's got separation anxiety or fear that or your cat are exhibiting those symptoms.
Yeah, I think that there's kind of a lot we can do with melatonin potentially. I have seen that work pretty successfully for some animals. And also behavior modification as well, and, you know, consulting with a trainer or a behaviorist. You know, I think that's one of the hardest things that I see is, yes, I'm a veterinarian, but I am claim not to be a behaviorist. And so we do have a lot of people coming in with anxiety issues, you know. So we always start with kind of the supplement stuff first, like melatonin, you know, whatnot. But then there are other, you know, things that we can try, like Prozac. We try not to reach for those first mm-hmm. until we kind of know for sure what's going on. But, you know, behavior modification for sure, I think people forget about.
And people definitely can work with their veterinarian over most of these behavioral issues. There are specialists. So as I do surgery, we just got a board certified behaviorist.
Oh, wow.
Which
didn't
is really
know
the
that.
First in northern New England. They have one at Tufts, but we had not had one in the area. So there are people who do behavior training. They're more trainers, but she is a veterinarian. Dr. Calder is a veterinarian and a board certified behaviorist, and she just started last week. So sometimes they'll refer, you know, if you're a veterinarian, if it seems to be beyond them or we have a very severe case, they'll refer as they would for surgery or oncology or neurology.
Okay, good to know. Staying with the theme of what pets and humans have in common, we have a sea change in people's diets recently, gluten-free and keto and vegan. And it seems like pet food is moving in the same direction that people want to feed their dog and cats only grain-free or only probiotic. Is what do you think of this trend? Is it good or bad for their health?
I think it can go both ways. I think, you know, it's definitely a trend where people kind of, you know, portray onto their pets what they want in their kind of lifestyle. And I think they forget that, you know, pets aren't necessarily human, you know, and I totally love the term fur baby, but, you know, they are a different species. And I think people can forget that. You know, I see a lot of cat foods out there with, you know, rice and carrots and peas in it, and cats are carnivores, you know, where dogs, on the other hand, are more omnivores. They can eat and do like a variety of those things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as we start to see these pet food companies become smaller and smaller and use different protein sources and different, you know, sources out there really that haven't been studied, we don't know, you know, the effect on animals long term. We've already seen some issues potentially related, you know, to cardiomyopathy with some of these smaller boutique, you know, diets. And so it's scary. We always just try to say as veterinarians, look for the AFCO label.
What is that balanced again? I know you've talked about this before, but what is that label?
So that means that it's nutritionally balanced. They've looked at it for life stages and that it's, you know, again, it's just fully balanced. It has everything that they need in terms of growth and development and maintenance, basically. And so that's definitely the most important thing to look for if you're looking for balance.
And it has to be right there on the bag.
Yes.
It does.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I just try to tell people, they say, you know, what should I be feeding? What do you feed? And some people will look at me in shock when I tell them what I'm feeding my dog, because I think, you know, what I feed is totally fine. But I always tell people, if it's balanced, even if it's over the counter, if they're not fat, if they aren't having an allergy to it, if they're tolerating it, if their stools, you know, their GI tract loves it, then it's fine. You don't have to spend $100 on a bag of food if you don't want to.
Same with the trends about raw food or fresh food. Same thing. Keep it simple. You don't have to go that route.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I've certainly seen some dogs that do well on it. But again, I think that we, you know, if it's doesn't have preservatives, if it's not prepared a certain way, it gets scary. There are some raw diets out there that are commercially made that are pretty safe. But when people start making their own raw diets and feeding raw, we forget about the bacterial issue there.
Yeah, Cindy, this is very similar to supplements, is that we can't really argue with success. So if an owner comes in and says that I fed my dog one of the major manufacturer diets for 4 years, they had terrible allergies, and they've been feeding raw for the past 4 years, and their problems are solved, I cannot argue with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't feed my dog raw food. I use one of the major manufacturers, and he's perfectly healthy. I trust, as we said before, evidence-based.
Uh-huh.
And so this trend with the grain-free was going on for a while, and people swore by it. And then after a while, we realized that that could be detrimental to their heart function.
And that did come
out in the news.
The cardiovascular issues people were having. And it all sort of narrowed down to a grain-free diet.
Yeah.
So that part was
and it's still,
pretty strong correlation.
Still a little bit to be determined. Yeah, strong enough correlation that it made us all stop and say, wait a minute, maybe this isn't right. And unfortunately, it takes years to figure this stuff out. So these other companies that go through the R&D and put money into that, we know that those dogs are not going to have issues over a lifetime study. So the larger companies will feed a dog that food. And I know I've said this on the show in the past, but from the time they're born and until the time they die, and we know that there are no side effects.
Huh. Okay. We have a tweet from Lucy. My cat is about 1.5, and I've only fed her dry food so far. How do I know if I should start feeding her wet or a combination of both? What's the healthiest option for her?
That's a great question. I feel like a lot of people feel strongly about cats should only eat wet food or dry food or whatnot. And I honestly feel like they should have both. And the reason why I say that is because I do like the crunchy kibbles for their teeth. It adds some variety, but also the wet food is really important in cats. Cats themselves don't drink a lot of water just as a species. Mm-hmm. And cats can have some urinary issues related to diet sometimes, related to stress. And the more water they have, the better. And sometimes just with canned food, that allows them to have a lot of more moisture content. And it's really hard sometimes to get a cat to take medications, or if they need a prescription diet and it's only canned, and if they've never had canned before in their life, they won't need it. So I usually encourage people to feed both right from the beginning if it's possible. And that's all opinion, but.
Okay, real quick before the break, we'll go to Mackenzie in Portland. I think another food question. Hi, Mackenzie.
Hi. We have a cat that kind of runs our household. We also have a dog, and the cat has started eating the dog food. And we're trying to figure out if this is going to be harmful to her and we need to do something about it, or if we can kind of let them work it out.
Your cat sounds great, first of all. I think we see that pretty commonly. I just had a cat the other day in the exam room take a dog treat out of the dog dish. So I don't think it's detrimental. I mean, if it's not, you know, the main source, if it's just going there and having tidbits here and there, I don't think that's going to be a big deal.
Okay, well, great. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will go to more of your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. We will be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com. And the Freeman Ellis Family Fund, supporting Maine Public Radio, local, national, and international news you can trust.
Gun control has emerged as a key issue in Virginia in campaigns for the state legislature. In Virginia Beach, a mass shooting this spring that left 12 dead has put the issue into sharp relief.
I see some people who would never be political coming out and saying something's got to change.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered today from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Political speech is protected by the Constitution, but who protects voters from lies?
Basically, what they're doing is what you would call false logic. They're taking 1 + 1 and getting 11 instead of 2.
The truth about political advertising. That's next time on The Takeaways Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRI.
And that's this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, we're talking about some of the challenging issues that affect pets in today's complicated society. And our panelists are ready to take your questions. Joining me, Dr. Ezra Steinberg. He's a surgeon with Maine Veterinary Medical Center. And Dr. Jennifer Kopp. She is with Tender Touch Veterinary Hospital. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Dr. Kopp, you were talking earlier with me about how allergies are yet another thing that we humans and pets share this time of year in particular? Or what kinds of things happen around now?
Yeah, this summer was particularly terrible, I feel like. I feel like every dog that I saw was coming in with some sort of itching issue. And so, I mean, Maine itself has a lot of environmental allergens. Pollen this year was terrible. And I don't think that people are always aware that sometimes their dog in the summer when they get itchy, it can be a seasonal allergy. And so we are seeing a lot of that, and it can be anything from red skin to itching to hot spots. So it's pretty common.
Okay. We will go now to Jean calling from Moody. Hi, Jean. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I have, this is my fourth golden retriever. He's 9-10 months old. And a history of the Goldens I know is that they love to chew and eat everything. But this gentleman, Charlie, is persistent on the grass and the dirt. Now, he's gotten sick now 3 times, so we've put a mask on him, and that didn't work because he can get through it. And then we did find this out fox a woman had created. It's like a fencing mask that somebody would use for fencing. And he actually, obviously, it does stop him from getting at the grass and the dirt. And she, the woman that created this item said that eventually he will understand that it's more fun playing with a ball instead of eating dirt. And we're not really seeing that happen. And he's been on it now for 2 months. Is there any nutrition issue, or is it just something that they do?
Ezra, what do you think?
Yeah, so, Jean, thanks for calling in. You're talking to somebody who deals with dogs that eat foreign material all the time. I'm sorry that Charlie is like that, but I can tell that I love him because a young golden puppy is one of my favorite things on the planet. So the basket muzzle or some sort of deterrent to not allow them to eat something foreign, whether it's grass or dirt or rocks or socks, is really the best way to prevent that from happening. I myself do not think that dogs learn to not eat something because they get more excited about something else, and sometimes they just have it in their head that they want to eat farm material. I've had dogs that I've operated on half a dozen times for eating socks, and the dog doesn't learn. They don't realize that eating that sock lands them a vacation in the hospital for 48 hours and a surgical incision. The question is, there is some underlying reason to it. So it's called PICA, P-I-C-A, and certainly there can be some sort of nutritional deficiency, liver disease. I find, unfortunately, that that is rare. So if your dog is eating foreign objects, it is absolutely worth your while getting some basic screening blood work and having a full physical exam and making sure that there's no underlying cause. Unfortunately, I think that that is more uncommon, and it's more that dogs just like to eat other things. The grass thing, ironically, I've had a handful of dogs that have actually obstructed off of grass this year, which I haven't really seen in the past. Dr. Rubin, my associate, the other surgeon as well, has cut a handful of these dogs this year as well. For it's usually this long grass, like reeds or near the ocean. It gets kind of tangled up and braided and can become a really, really bad obstructive object in the intestine that requires surgery. So if your dog is eating grass, I would stop them pretty quickly and not let them just continue to take it all in.
Okay, good luck with that, Gene. Thanks for calling. We have an email from Andrew. He says, we have a 13-year-old male cat who was born with a narrow urethra. After a surgery 7 years ago to remove crystals in his urinary tract at the advice of our vet, we took him off of any dry food and give him a L-methionine supplement daily. Do you recommend anything else in addition to or instead of this?
I mean, the most important thing would be keeping the high moisture content, so canned food, increasing water content, and then just checking a urinalysis pretty regularly to make sure there's not crystals still accumulating or redeveloping. You know, a lot of male cats in general have narrow urethras, so if he was born with a narrower one, then that's very, you know, not ideal. But I would just continue to screen regularly with your primary care vet and keep him on the appropriate diet.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. And I have to ask you, Jen, I asked you earlier whether you see more dogs or cats, and I understand you are quite the cat person. You want to tell us about how many you have?
I mean, currently I'm down to four, but, you know, and I do love dogs and cats equally, but I feel like cats definitely have a special place in my heart in terms of veterinary medicine. They're just a different type of animal, you know, in the way that they react, and they do have a little special place in my heart.
They do. I've worked with her before, and I know they have a very special place in her
and
heart.
I can't help asking, too. I mean, in your profession, do you end up taking home animals sometimes just because no one else does or they need it?
Unfortunately, yes. That's how I have accumulated a few of them. And, you know, it's not always, you know, from, you know, an owner. It's a lot of times strays will come in. But, yeah, I mean, sometimes there's animals that have a lot of medical needs that are very hard to manage. And just fortunately, we're in a position where we can. So, yeah, unfortunately.
Big-hearted veterinarians.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll go to Sylvia calling from Camden. Hi, Sylvia. What's your question?
Hi. Well, some comments on nutrition. A couple of things. I have two 12-year-old outdoor cats, and they're neutered. And I noticed, and I live in a woody area, and I noticed that years ago, when I started giving them nutritional yeast flakes on their food, I have no more fleas or ticks, maybe one tick now and then, but that has totally eliminated that problem. And they love it, and it's really good. You can get it in the grocery store or the health food store. It's in the season section. And I also give one of my cats yogurt. He gets organic, full-fat yogurt, and he loves it, and his fur looks great. What else? The other thing I check out, I think I feed my cats better than I do myself. The one thing I've read about is that most foods have something on the label called meat byproducts. And I have read things about that just, it makes it sound absolutely gross what can go into a meat byproduct. And so I would check labels when you're buying food to not have that be listed on there. Good foods won't carry meat byproducts. The meat byproducts, well, the worst article is they can throw everything in there, including euthanized animals and roadkill, and just mush it all up. So,
okay, Sylvia, let's let our veterinarians weigh in on, I guess, two parts there. One is about the tick preventative. Have you heard of that technique?
I haven't, about the yeast flakes. I have not heard that. And this is the same thing that we talked about before. If it's working for you, that's fantastic. It's just like without evidence, Sylvia, it's really hard for us to recommend that, right? If we don't know if there's research behind it, but it sounds like I wouldn't mind coming back in my next life being one of your cats.
Thank you, Sylvia. And she did mention the meat byproducts. Is that something?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, unfortunately, that everyone can have their own opinion, but I do think it is a misconception. A lot of the meat byproducts actually have a lot of the essential things that the pets need. And so people think of meat byproducts and they get kind of grossed out. But I don't know, especially for outdoor kitties, I like to say, have you seen what they eat out there? Uh-huh. And a lot of times, you know, it's bone. You know, they're eating whole skulls and things like that. And so meat byproducts, you know, usually are bones and other organs ground up, which do carry a lot of the essential nutrients that our pets do need. So I try to encourage people not to get freaked out by that. It's actually not a bad thing.
Kind of nature's way.
Yes.
Huh?
Yeah.
Okay. We have an email from Jason. I would love for the vets to provide any ways pet owners can protect dogs from recent kennel cough outbreaks in the Bath, Brunswick area, other than the obvious Bordetella vaccine.
Yeah. So, this is like a repeated statement that we make about prevention. Mm-hmm. And Jason, the vaccine we certainly recommend, and you should talk to your veterinarian about staying up to date and whatever their vaccine protocol is for that. But just it is a disease that's carried when dogs meet each other. So staying away from dog parks if you're not up to date on vaccines or boarding facilities, or even if you have friends coming over that are bringing a dog, it's a question that you could ask them. But it's really prevention. And if your dog is home alone and not getting face-to-face with some strange dogs, it's very unlikely to contract kennel cough.
Okay, we'll try to get to as many of these that are coming in as we can. Email from Ben. My dog, a 4-year-old Shih Tzu Bichon mix, chews his paws constantly. I've looked it up online, and it seems like it'd be a nervous habit. I'm hoping your guest could talk about the potential causes and the ways to address the behavior. He doesn't seem to be interested in alternatives when we notice he's doing it and try to get him to chew on something else, like a toy.
I think my biggest worry would be, is he actually itchy? So sometimes dogs will lick or kind of over-groom, sometimes chew at things, and it's actually because they're very itchy, and paws can definitely be a major area where they have allergies, especially if they're allergic to certain grasses or whatever. And so there can be contact allergies as well. So I would definitely consult your veterinarian and consider that maybe he's actually just very itchy potentially.
Okay, we have a call from Friedrichs calling from Milo. Hi, what's your question?
Well, a couple. One is, do chickens and roosters eat Lyme ticks?
Okay, I've heard that. Is that the case?
I think so. I know guinea hens in particular are like very effective at eating ticks, but you know.
Chickens absolutely do.
There you go.
Yeah, they'll clean your yard and you should not have ticks.
I've heard turkeys too. Okay, and you had another question.
Yeah, next is I understand that the Lyme ticks hang out between the edge of your lawn and the beginning of the woods where the grass gets taller. Is that right?
Yeah, so They definitely, I mean, they can be anywhere. So it's usually where the grass is taller, but you can, I've had them just playing in my yard. And they're deer ticks, the ones that carry Lyme disease. They can just be in short grass as well. You're not really protected if you are outside.
Okay, thanks for calling, Friedrichs. We will go now to Amanda calling from Phippsburg. Hi, Amanda. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call. I have two older cats, maybe 12 and 15 years old. One is a male, one is a female. And we have just introduced a new female. She's also older. She's about 12 years old. Or I think she was like a single cat and a single, like, she's the only animal. The new cat doesn't like the other animals in the house at all. She hisses and spits. And when the two females get together, they are very aggressive with each other. They like scratch and claw and draw blood. And very, very interesting. So my question is there any ways that we can, any intervention that we can do to let them be a little more friendly with each other, or do they just need to fight it out?
I would not recommend letting them fight it out. As you can see, it can get pretty nasty. But a lot of times when we want to introduce, new cats to a household, we recommend doing it slowly. So ideally, the new kitty, especially if she hasn't been around other cats before, giving her own safe space. So a lot of times we'll suggest keeping them in their own room for a while and just letting her get used to that environment, the smells, bringing cat beds or blankets from the other cats into the room so she gets used to that. And then, eventually they will kind of interact underneath the door a little bit. You can feed her, feed them on other side of the door, let them get used to each other and kind of slowly introduce them. Some cats will never accept other cats. And so it's just about creating a safe space. And a lot of times they will figure out a way to kind of respect each other, where if you can just make sure she's always got a safe place, she can climb and hide from them if she needs to. But it definitely sometimes can take a long time, like months to years potentially, and they may never be best friends, but we definitely recommend taking it slow and certainly avoid any kind of physical interactions or fights if possible.
Thanks for calling, Amanda. Good luck. We have a comment from Joni on Facebook. I hope you talk about neutering and unclaimed neighborhood cats. I've adopted plenty of porch cats, but I'm running out of funds to have them all neutered.
Yeah, so Joni, thanks for doing that and helping out with this problem, which is pretty severe, especially in some areas of Portland as well. And this TNR trap neuter release program exists in a lot of places. So I would call your closest humane society, and oftentimes they are able to help you out. But thanks for doing your part.
Okay, we'll take another quick break right now. This is Maine Calling. We will be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Farmland Trust, celebrating 20 years of growing the future for farming. Share your stories and get involved at MaineFarmlandTrust20th.org. The Dempsey Center, making life better for people managing the impact of cancer. Locations in Lewiston and South Portland, DempseyCenter.org. And the Lunder Foundation, founding partner of Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical.
A New Hampshire woman gets a call from her nephew, and he tells her he can't buy high-capacity magazines in Connecticut.
He said, so I was wondering if I could use your address to have these high-capacity magazines sent to your house.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, raising a red flag on a member of the family. Plus, the hardwood industry is getting hammered in the trade war with no reprieve. Please join us.
That's today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
There can be a lot of psychological noise involved in teaching.
A plus.
Great job.
Great job.
You keep messing up. How are you not getting
this? Way to go.
Let's try that.
But what if you replace all that chit-chat with a click? How an animal training tool is helping new surgeons learn their craft. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
That's Sunday morning at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, news and advice on keeping your pets healthy and happy. Joining me, Dr. Jennifer Kopp is with Tender Touch Veterinary Hospital, and Dr. Ezra Steinberg is with Maine Veterinary Medical Center. Please join the conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. And Dr. Kopp, you had talked to me a little bit about heartworm prevention. I know for me, I know with my dog, I let this slide, but you would say that we really need to pay attention to heartworm.
Yeah, I think that's the most alarming trend I've seen recently is kind of we're going away from a lot of the preventatives that we used to be pretty strict about. And, you know, I think part of it, unfortunately, is we're getting many more positive heartworm cases in the state of Maine. And yes, a lot of these positive cases tend to be some dogs that were brought up from the south. And so, you know, in the south, heartworm is much more prevalent and it was pretty much never heard of here. But what is happening is we are seeing dogs become positive that have been born and bred in Maine, never left. And that's because, unfortunately, with all this rescue, we are bringing up some dogs that are carrying heartworm. And a lot of people don't realize that it's spread by mosquitoes. And so our mosquitoes who were heartworm free basically take a blood meal from these heartworm positive dogs. Now they're in the environment biting our dogs and spreading it. And basically, you know, it's just becoming more endemic in our area. And, you know, a lot of the clients that I'm seeing come in not up to date on heartworm prevention, you know, and don't feel the need to test. And it's just extremely, extremely important because it is definitely becoming more prevalent and it can be fatal. So it's very important that we get the dogs back on this because it's becoming more common.
So just ask your veterinarian for what they recommend. That it's a monthly, it a monthly treatment?
Or? So, yeah, in general, it's a monthly pill. And what people don't realize, too, is it's called preventative. So they assume it's like flea and tick where it'll basically last for the next month coming up. Really what the heartworm prevention does is it kills the last month of exposure.
Oh.
So it doesn't, if you give your dog a pill, it doesn't protect for the next 30 days. It's actually working retroactively. And, you know, the testing, too, is extremely important. And the test isn't always accurate. Your dog can have one male heartworm but come up negative because the only way we get a positive test is if the animal has female heartworms. And so it's a little tricky, but we definitely recommend screening and doing that annually. And that's where that testing comes in, is also tests for the Lyme, Ehrlichian, Anaplasma as well. So when we're recommending this annually, it's not just because, hey, you know, we just need to do this test for potential money. I mean, it really is important that we're keeping, you know, our population safe.
When you mentioned the mosquitoes, is that the only way it's spreading, or how else can you get it?
Yeah, it's with the mosquitoes. And there are certain life stages that it has to go through. But there's a host and a vector. And unfortunately, you know, the vector is the mosquito and the host is the dog. And, you know, it's a significant problem.
What about cats?
So cats can get it. It's not nearly as common. They're not as good of a host, but we have seen it this year in cats as well. So,
okay, we have an email from Mike. We have a 2-year-old American Bulldog, American Staffordshire mix, and she seems to have really bad chin acne. We have a cream that's been given to us by her veterinarian. Is there anything else that we could do to kind of minimize this chin acne?
Mike, thanks for getting in touch with us. I would say that most acne or pimples or pustules on dogs, this all goes back to our allergies. So sometimes it can be related to allergies. Sometimes if it's on their chin, it can be from their water bowl and washing their water bowl regularly. Maybe this is more a problem in cats, but I assume with dogs. But if there's some bulldog in there, some Amstaff in there, it's also sometimes their skin's a little bit wrinkly, and it can be just an infection from being where it doesn't get exposed to air. But I would talk to your vet because it could be yeast or it could be bacteria, and there are certain topical treatments that could get rid of the problem if you're washing the water bowls already. And then beyond that, it's left to that allergy hunt to see if it's an environmental allergy versus something in their food.
Okay, we'll go to Mary because she's following up on the heartworm conversation. So Mary calling from Bangor. Hi.
Yes. Hi. I had adopted a dog from North Carolina, and we adopted him in December. And when we adopted him, we went through a shelter, and they had us do a health screening before transporting them up to Maine. So we had thought that all of the screenings were done. When we received our dog, we had brought him in for his first vet appointment, and luckily our vet was super knowledgeable and just immediately drew blood and was like, you know, he's a southern dog. He really has to get this tested. And we were like, oh, he's already been tested. He's fine. Well, it turned out that he was heartworm positive. And so we went through this like 6 month journey of trying to treat for heartworm. Mm-hmm. And it was a really scary experience because we had just got this dog thinking that we were doing a good thing, adopting him from a shelter. And our vet told us, you know, he could die at any moment during this treatment. And this is really serious. And we have to make sure that we do this a certain way. And we went through a series of shots. And basically at any moment during the treatment, he could have an allergic reaction or could go into heart failure. And so just like really stressing, just a comment about really stressing when you adopt from out of state, it's really important to do the test regardless of whether or not you've had a health certificate to transport, because we had thought that that was done and it wasn't done. And ended up, we could have spread it to all the dogs in our neighborhood or to our own dog that we have.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Thank you, Mary. Thanks for that. And we'll go now to Michelle calling from Portland. Hi, Michelle. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I so appreciate this topic. It's been wonderful. So I was actually calling with a behavior question about my kitty. He doesn't have any underlying health problems. He has a clean ear analysis and is doing really well. And he's healthy, but what he can't seem to do is go in his litter box anymore. And we've tried everything. We've got the litter, the cat attract litter, and tried all kinds of different litter boxes. And he will use it for a day maybe after we get him something new, and then he'll go maybe on the floor or in the bathtub. And I was wondering if you had any recommendations, something that I haven't thought about, to try to help with that issue.
Sure, Michelle. I think this is a common issue for people. Any tips?
Well, it sounds like you're certainly taking the right steps. The Cat Attract is a product that I do really like. And I mean, aside from exploring all other issues, you know, have we tried moving the litter box, putting it where he does go? I think this kind of moves perfectly into the new behavior. So we'll be starting to get NVMC. But really, yeah, it's just about exploring all those avenues. And it sounds like if he's healthy and you've done the vet check, then it really does just become an exploration of, you know, what else could potentially be causing the problem. And unfortunately, sometimes it sounds like we've explored all avenues we're capable of, and it might meet a behaviorist that, you know, may need to step in next.
So we talked about that earlier. Not every veterinary center has a behavioralist, right? So do people just ask for recommendations, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is up to the veterinarian themselves to kind of know when they've explored kind of all the avenues that they can explore, and then realize, okay, this is beyond the scope of, you know, what we're capable of figuring out. And then behaviorists really do have, you know, special training, and a lot of times they can, you know, have solutions that we never would have thought of. And so I would encourage, you know, people in situations like this to certainly ask for referrals.
Okay, hope that works out, Michelle. And this wins probably for the cute email of the day, email from Cindy. I recently adopted a guinea pig from a shelter. He has a great appetite, but eats only guinea pig pellets and Timothy hay. I tried carrots and apples, but he won't touch them. My other piggies always loved fruits and veggies. Is Bingo just finicky? Bingo. Do you guys both see pocket pets, or do they count as pocket pets?
They do. They come into our hospital. Yeah, for sure. They come into our hospital. I'm not sure about appetite related and how you get a guinea pig. You can lead a guinea pig to food, but you can't get them to eat. I'm not really sure about that one.
I know that pellets tend to be kind of like candy for them. And so the fact that eating Timothy hay is great, I would encourage more hay than pellets. If he doesn't like fruits and veggies, like maybe trying some spinach or other lettuce type, you know, stuff rather than just fruits and vegetables. But he may just be finicky, and that's not a bad thing. If all he ate was hay, that's not a bad thing either. So
even without the pellets, just hay alone.
Right. Yep. It's best for their gut.
Huh. Good to know. And we will go now to Margie calling from Jonesboro. Hi, Margie. How are you?
Hi. Oh, well, I'm doing good, but I have a border collie. And I have 41-acre water frontage, and he's itching, and I've been taking ticks off him because, you know, there's deer and everything all over the place. But I want to know what you can put on to sort of keep the ticks away or something for his itching. I did get the neem, and I also got Dr. Goodbar for itching, the drops, and I don't know what the heck. I mean, and I look his body. He's brushed every single day, three times a day, but I don't know why he's itching. You can't see anything.
Okay, let's see what the veterinarians say, Margie.
So I would definitely say getting a veterinary-approved flea and tick preventative first. And this brings up something that we didn't really talk about before. You can buy some over-the-counter tick and flea preventatives. You can buy them on major online retailers, and some of them are definitely not backed by veterinarians and actually can be harmful. In terms of the itching, this goes back to our allergy thing, and sometimes it can be a flea allergy. So if you find ticks on them, you might also find fleas on them. But on 41 acres, there can be a lot of different stuff, and that sounds magical up there. There's also some other stuff for allergies that veterinarians can now prescribe that have come out in the past couple years. There are shots, monthly shots, to help with allergies. There's a new drug that sort of decreases the sensation of itching, which has been a breakthrough in our field. So I would take this friend into the vet and talk to your veterinarian.
Good luck, Margie. We will go now to a message from Kyle. My cat is feisty and will hit or swat when she's annoyed. Any tips for effective ways to tell her that's not okay?
Unfortunately, not. I think kind of figuring out what's making her do that, and some cats can be pretty sensitive about where their pet, you know, where they're being patted particularly. But again, I think a behaviorist, if it's something that's kind of going beyond or if she's actually causing injury, would be the next place to look.
Are there old wives' tales that you would say these are misconceptions, don't do this? People who say they're spraying with water or whatever different kinds of disciplinary things?
Yeah, I mean, I think each pet responds differently to things. I mean, I certainly know some people who have sprayed their cats with water before and it works. Honestly, I have tried that with one of my cats and he just like plays with the water. So it really just depends on the
individual cat.
This is your philosophy of raising pets or children. There's positive reinforcement and there's negative reinforcement.
Exactly.
There's
all
two
the same
major schools of thought with behaviorists. And so whoever you're working with, I would listen to there. There's a guy on Animal Planet that strongly believes in negative reinforcement, which is frowned upon by many of the behaviorists, and it's really all about positive reinforcement is the recent trend.
Okay. We will try to squeeze in one more question from Chad calling from Biddeford. Hi, Chad.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I know it's getting late, so I'll make it quick.
Okay.
We have an indoor-outdoor cat, and this thing is a four-legged death machine to smaller animals. You know, there were four more rodent variations on the deck this morning. But my real question is, I saw recently there's been a precipitous drop in the bird population noted. And our cat kills a bunch of birds. And I was just thinking the other day, boy, if multiply that by how many cats are out there outdoors. And I just want to ask the guests, do you think there's a direct correlation between the drop in bird population and the booming cat population, especially, you know, the indoor outdoors or strictly outdoors?
Thanks for that question. Thanks, Chad. We just had a report on that today about the decline in the bird population. It's really dramatic. Are cats part of that?
I don't know. I would be shocked. We do get these murderer cats that I will have clients every now and then that say that their cat is just an amazing hunter. I can't really believe that they would influence the bird population, but I have nothing to back that up besides my intuition.
What are your comments about keeping cats inside in general, though, on that front?
On that front?
As far as, well, whether they're killing birds or just
right,
outdoor versus indoor cats.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two schools of thought. I mean, obviously, if they're inside, they're much safer. You know, outside, there are risks. They can be preyed upon by other, you know, other animals. They can get hit by cars. You know, they can get into trucks and be driven away if they're curious cats. So there's always risk. And I think it's just knowing how to keep them safe and keep them, you know, safe with their preventatives as well.
Okay, well, that's the final word for today. Thank you both for joining us. Dr. Ezra Steinberg is with Maine Veterinary Medical Center, and Dr. Jennifer Kopp is with Tender Touch Veterinary Hospital. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Sandra Harris took your calls, and our theme song was composed by Mike Jandreau. You can find links and resources and recordings of past shows at mainecalling.org. I'm Cindy Hahn. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Have a great weekend.